I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Last year, Upper Darby, just outside of Philadelphia, recorded 200 overdoses, more than half of them from heroin and most of the rest from prescription drugs. Police and first responders now carry Narcan to help save someone who is overdosing. The Upper Darby Police Department has begun a new program, Change is Possible, to deal with the township's drug problems. Addicts can come to the police station if they want help. They'll be referred to a treatment program or provider. And this is reportedly the first police department in Pennsylvania to use this kind of treatment approach to addiction. We asked Upper Darby Police Superintendent Michael Chitwood to join us on Radio Times, and good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. So is heroin, prescription drugs, is that fueling Upper Darby's drug problems?
It is. It is very, very significantly, as it is across the rest of the country.
And when did you begin to notice that?
About 2 years ago, we started to see numbers of drug overdose deaths start to raise its ugly head, and as we monitored it more closely, especially in 2015, we saw that there were 20 heroin deaths and 133 heroin OD overdoses. So we figured, you know, we can arrest people who are selling it. I mean, that's our major goal. I mean, I truly believe that addiction is a disease and it needs to be treated as such. But at the same time, police are really stuck with what they can do and can't do, and especially when it comes to rehab. So we developed a protocol, and we looked across the country to see what other police departments were doing, and we came up with our Changes Possible program.
You posted a video not so long ago of a man actually shooting up heroin on a SEPTA bus. What were you trying to say by posting that video?
Well, I was trying to show three things. First, how desperate somebody is who is addicted to opioid, to include heroin. And that video certainly shows it. When you can't even wait to get home, you need to shoot up in a bus. The second thing is that I wanted to show what the men and women and first responders do day in and day out, saving lives. For example, just in Upper Darby, since first of the year last year, 2015, until present, till today, 74 uses of Narcan, and we saved 64 lives.
Wow.
That's an amazing data. 74 and 64 saves. We had four DOAs and a couple that there was no reaction. And the third thing I wanted to say was we need some type of platform to help people get into treatment. Now, I've been around a long time, and I know that just because you put somebody in treatment doesn't mean they're going to succeed. It's guesstimated that it could take anywhere from 8 to 12 relapses before somebody really can kick the habit or, you know, remain sober or start to get sober. So it's a very, very significant process, and that's where we are. I mean, when you fight the drug problem, it's no different than when you were fighting in the late 60s and early 70s.
But what I hear you saying is that while treatment is difficult, treating drug use as a crime is not helping and perhaps even making things worse.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with that. You know, the dope dealer, he or she should go to jail. I don't have any second thoughts about that. And, you know, our undercover guys are making an arrest every day out here or making buys every day out on the street, and eventually we're going to lock up the dope dealer. In the last couple of weeks, we've made three significant arrests where we got over, you know, 1,000 bags of heroin, $5,000 in cash, you know, uncut cocaine. And I think you got to look at the problem. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, heroin was a big problem in Philadelphia.
Right.
Methadone was the treatment, you know. And then what you did is you created a group of methadone addicts. So what you were dealing with on the street was a heroin product that was 5 to 7% pure, and the rest was baking soda. So even though you were having drug overdoses, deaths, it was nowhere near what it is today. Today, the heroin on the street is anywhere from 80 to 90% pure, and it's cut with fentanyl, which is five times more powerful than the heroin. So when you add that together, that's why you're having so many people dying right and left across the country. So it is a major problem, but there's not enough rehabilitation for those people, or rehabilitation points of entry for those people who become addicted to the opioids, especially the heroin.
Well, you want to make the police department or the police headquarters or station a point of entry. So how would this Change Is Possible program, how would that work? Let's say someone has a drug problem. What do they do?
Basically how it works, the first thing we had to do, we had to reach out to what we consider a foremost drug rehabilitation, alcohol rehabilitation organization, and we looked at Gaudenzia. Gaudenzia started back in the late 60s in a little row home in North Philadelphia at 18th, 17th, and Tioga. And I have seen it grow over the years into, you know, it's a mega corporation right now. So what I did is I reached out to them. The mayor of Upper Darby, Tom McCosey, and myself went up and met with the CEO of Gaudenzia and several of his staff members. And basically, we pitched to them what we would like to do is make the Upper Darby Police Department a point of entry for somebody who is addicted and needs help. The help has to be voluntary. They have to come in on their own. We're starting out small, so we want to make sure that it's open to Upper Darby residents because that's where we're having the problem. And then how do you get through the bureaucracy? Because that's where the nightmare, you know, do I have insurance? Do I not have insurance? Will they accept it? Will they not accept it? And what they did is they assigned three social workers and drug rehabilitation specialists to handle anybody who would come in the Upper Darby Police Headquarters and would want help. And those people would take the individual to three points of entry in Delaware County, the first one being Keystone, the second one being Chester Crozier Hospital, the third one being Northwestern, which are all in Delaware County. And those three institutions or facilities would take the person who was seeking help and be able to test them and talk to them and find out, do they need detox, do they need rehabilitation, where that would take place, how it would take place, and then if they had no insurance, make sure that financially they could get into the treatment programs. And if they did have insurance, what it would cost or what it would not cost.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Upper Darby Police Superintendent Michael Chitwood. We're talking about a new program just unveiled last week. It's a program to help some of the drug addicts or users in Upper Darby, which is just outside of Philadelphia. It's called Change Is Possible. And if you want to comment on it, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is a pretty brand new program. Have you had any takers, Michael Chitwood?
We've had a couple of callers, but no takers. So what I want to do now is, when you look at the numbers of people with Narcan, for example, this past weekend we had a 54-year-old woman dead, but then we had three or four others that we Narcaned. And what I would like to do, even though Delaware County is in the process of hiring two drug rehabilitation specialists, and their job will be to go around, and anybody in the county that's Narcaned, they go and visit them and offer them help. What I would like to do is take those three volunteers we have from Gaudenzia and have them go to anybody in Upper Darby because, you know, I mean, when you look at Delaware County, it's a huge county, but then 40% of the heroin overdoses are in Upper Darby. 40% of whatever it happens in the county.
That's a lot.
So that's what I would like to do, and obviously I need permission to do that, and we'll go forward. And again, the goal is to afford people who want help. Now, do you have a hurdle to overcome? Absolutely, because when people are using heroin, their major goal in life is to get the next high. That's all they care about. That's all they care about. And that's a difficult proposition. So while we're trying to make a safe haven and, you know, a place to negotiate treatment, the addict himself or herself, all they care about is getting high. You know, it's just what they do.
Well, and just a couple, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, only just a couple more minutes before I have to say goodbye to you. But if someone has drugs on them, if they have an open court case, if they're on probation, parole, is the police department, is that a safe haven for that person?
It would be a safe haven to come in. I mean, obviously, if you're going to be bringing drugs into the police department, unless you're surrendering them, you got to be foolish, number one. So I can't allow that to happen. If you have an open court case, then the courts have their own drug program, and I don't want to interfere with anything that they're doing. If you're on probation and parole, and you're not wanted, then certainly we would be willing to help. I mean, the goal is to help anybody we can. We got to start out small, and then see how it works out, and then expand it. Mm-hmm. But if somebody called in and they lived in, we had a couple calls from Philadelphia, we give them a number, a hotline number, and they can call that number to get help, or certainly to get into the bureaucracy of trying to get help. But, you know, the problem is there's so many people addicted to heroin, and there's not enough facilities to handle the numbers. It's just staggering. It's mind-boggling.
What's been the public response in Upper Darby?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, people, especially those family members of people who have either died and or are addicted, I mean, they're very, very supportive of the program. And we'll see. You know, time will tell.
Yeah. Well, do you see yourself as kind of running an experiment to see if this would work in Pennsylvania?
I see us running a helping hand environment, you know, and the police being the first point of entry. That's what I see. I mean, I'm going forward with this, and I just hope and pray that if we can save one life and put one person back on track, we've succeeded.
And you have to have a different view about the police department, do you not, if you're using drugs and seeing the police department as a place where you could actually get help as opposed to being arrested?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, my officers are on board, and, you know, we're ready to help. We're ready to open the doors.
And you'll know if this is working how?
I'll know if it's working how by, A, the numbers of people who come in, and then, B, you know, how many people we can get into a detox or rehab or a combination of both.
Well, on that note, Michael Chitwood, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And he's Upper Darby Police Superintendent talking about a new program they just unveiled called Change is Possible. Well, coming up after the break, Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder will be talking with education reporter Ben Harold about technology in the classroom. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm producer Debbie Bilder, sitting in for Radio Times. Peek into any classroom and you'll find it filled with technology. Teachers using interactive whiteboards, kids using computers, tablets, even their phones. And a lot of schoolwork is done online too. Students research projects, write papers, read digital textbooks, and watch video lectures. Technology has seeped into schools just as it has into all other aspects of our lives. But is it improving education and helping kids become better learners? Do all kids have access to it? And what effects is all this tech having on teaching? We've asked Benjamin Harold to fill us in on the research around digital education. He's a staff writer for Education Week, where he covers education technology and writes the Digital Education blog. Welcome, Ben.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, technology is everywhere in education, and I'm wondering, what is the goal of all this technology in classrooms? What are people hoping it will do to transform education?
Well, I think that depends on who you ask. There are certainly some who are looking to make money off it, and it's a big industry, and there's billions and billions of dollars that are going to hardware, software, administrative tools that go into the classroom. But the larger vision is really around often what you'll hear as personalized learning, this idea that the way instruction has happened in classrooms Times is based now, as it has been for a century, on kind of a factory model where everyone gets the same material at the same pace and sits in the same class, and you sit in rows and watch the front of the classroom and proceed through your educational career in that way. And there's a real push now to kind of break that up and to give each student kind of a customized educational experience and to have technology be the lever to do that, whether it's through the device that you're working on or the software that you're interacting with or the way that all of that kind of combines together to really get a pretty fine-grained picture based on data of what you know and can do and what you like and what you don't like and to personalize things based on that. So that's the vision. We're still pretty far away from that.
Well, we've been investing in technology for a while, certainly 5 years, tablets, computers, things like that have been in classrooms. What do we know about what's working? Is it working? Is it improving skills and scores?
One of the remarkable things about this dramatic influx of technology into the classroom is that we are spending so much money on it without knowing if it works. Mm-hmm. Right now, that there's a pretty limited research base around things like blended learning and one-to-one computing and so forth. And you'll see, you know, studies that kind of look at specific circumstances or specific products or specific type of school, and you might get kind of a picture of like, well, it kind of works under this kind of circumstance. But right now, there's not a real kind of comprehensive sense that this is an investment worth making. And in fact, there are some indicators that there might be some real downsides attached to it as well, that some of the achievement gaps we hear about between different groups of students, you know, more affluent students and lower income students or white students and minority groups, some of that might actually be exacerbated by the technology. So, you know, it's a real kind of time of flux right now. And, you know, it is surprising that we're investing so much money in this without really knowing what to make of it.
And you mentioned a big industry now developed around technology. Who is pushing technology into classrooms? Is it the government? Is it parents? Is it the industry?
I think you see it coming from a lot of different angles. The U.S. Department of Education and the federal government are certainly big backers of educational technology. You may have heard President Obama in his State of the Union address saying one of his priorities was mm-hmm. to get every student in the country writing computer code. And, you know, there's been a big push for that and from the federal government. You also see it from industry. You know, big companies, Apple certainly has a huge stake in having their iPads in the classrooms and related software with that. Google is a huge presence in classrooms now with Chromebooks and kind of a student-oriented version of a lot of the software applications that lots of professionals use, so, you know, Gmail and calendars and
Google
so forth.
Docs. I mean, my son's always doing Google Docs.
Yeah, you will see that a lot now. And then there's a huge startup industry now, too. There's a lot of smaller ed tech companies who are trying to solve particular problems or develop a math curriculum for seventh grade or, you know, working on science projects or simulations that might be good. And so, you know, it's coming from all sides. And a lot of teachers love it. A lot of teachers are doing really innovative and exciting things with it. And they're very enthusiastic about this kind of potential for them to do what a lot of good teachers have always tried to do, but just do it better and faster. You know, this notion of I can understand where each student is and try and customize to them. Teachers have been trying to do that. Good teachers have been mm-hmm. trying to do that for a long time. So the hope is that the technology makes that a little more efficient and a little more powerful. But, you know, there's a lot of resistance still as well, too.
Well, what technologies are we talking about? Because obviously there's sort of hardware, you know, mm-hmm. computers, tablets, things like that. And then there's a lot of software, a lot of curriculums. What are schools actually investing in?
There's a handful of big buckets. So devices is certainly a big part of it. Mm-hmm. There's been a huge influx of computers, tablets, laptops, netbooks, Chromebooks, all of those kinds of things into school. The current estimates are that, you know, roughly one computer for every 5 students nationally, probably even a lower ratio than that now. So devices is a big part. But in order to support those devices, you need infrastructure. And so there's a lot of money and a lot of push being made right now to make sure that there are effective Wi-Fi networks in classrooms and that school buildings have fast connections out to the internet. The federal government is spending a lot of money to help with that. And then there's the software industry. And so, as you described, there's lots of different kind of programs and, you know, math software and so forth. But there's also a lot of apps. And, you know, a lot of teachers will go out and find their own things and, you know, download apps for their students to use. And that creates both great opportunities and some potential problems as well. And then, you know, school districts are, you know, particularly in a place like Philadelphia, are big entities with a lot of back-end operational needs. So there's a lot of administrative software programs to, you know, everything from run budgets to plan facilities to keep track of your inventory. There's a huge industry around that as well.
Right. I mean, I think about the, you know, sort of IT people we have here at WHYY. I mean, schools will have to have all that staff too, right?
Yeah. You know, one of the big challenges that a lot of schools face is, you know, we've bought all of these laptops and we have all this great curriculum and we go to use it and our kids can't get online. And then you see the wheels spinning and the teachers are frustrated and the kids are starting to fall asleep and everyone kind of things fall apart. And so that, you know, there are big kind of structural challenges like that now, in addition to the, you know, even when everything is working, is it helping with teaching and learning?
Well, let's talk about some of the sort of promise of technology. I mean, one of the things advocates talk a lot about is something you mentioned earlier, this idea of personalized learning, which is this sort of adaptive way that I guess, you know, curriculums can kind of build around the student's strengths. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, how it's being used right now?
Yeah, the general approach with personalized learning is, you know, there's a couple kind of core ideas with it. One is that each student should have their own kind of personalized path. So you may want to be a radio producer and I might want to be president, and we'll have different paths kind of based on that. And then it's also based on our different skills and abilities. You might be strong in math, I might be strong in reading. And so, it, you know, the idea is that we should have an educational experience that caters to our interests, but also helps us extra where we need help. And then the third kind of big core pillar is this idea that we should progress through school not based on how long we sit in our seats, but on our ability to demonstrate that we've mastered the relevant content. And so, you know, the technology, a lot of it is kind of increasingly kind of built around those ideas. And, you know, you go to some schools, particularly some charter schools that have a little more freedom to experiment, or private schools that have been working on this for a while, and you'll see these kind of really different kind of looking models where instead of everyone working on the same thing at the same time, each student might have their own project that they're working on, or they might be getting remediation in kind of different ways, and there's a lot more different things happening in the classroom. So that's kind of one vision of it. Mm-hmm. There's also this other vision of technology that you'll see where it's, you know, the technology is a tool for people to create and express themselves and to work together and to do new and powerful things and to solve problems in their communities. And, you know, Philadelphia is actually kind of a hotbed for that philosophy with Science Leadership Academy and some of the other schools here who are experimenting with that. And that's very powerful as well. Also kind of happening on a fairly small scale, but this idea, you know, you'll see kids with their computers and, you know, technology tools and using sensors and building, growing gardens and doing projects out in the world to try and change that kind of instruction with technology as well.
So more creative, sort of tapping into a student's interests as well.
Mm-hmm. And what we see is that, you know, that there's kind of a digital divide in that way as well. A lot of times we think about the digital divide as, you know, one kid has access to a computer and the other doesn't, or one has an internet connection and the other doesn't. But there's this increasing sense that some students are being given opportunities to use technology to build things, to make things, to work together, to create, to express themselves, to kind of find out about themselves and do things that many parents would look at and say, that's the kind of education I really want for my child. Where in other, there's a sense that, you know, for many low-income and minority students in particular, that technology is being used more for drill and kill, for basics, for practice of basic skills, for this kind of, you know, it's not so much kids working on a project together with technology in the middle of it. It's a student and the computer working on remediation of kind of academic deficits. And so there's an increasing concern about a digital use divide that we hear about as well.
Huh. So there's another idea, another concept that's talked about a lot around digital education, and that's blended learning, which I guess is this sort of combination between face-to-face interactions, these sort of traditional interactions with teachers, and then various software, online programs, things like that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of the challenges I face in my job, and I'm paid 40 hours a week to pay attention to this stuff. So for parents, you know, I sympathize as well, because keeping track with all the terminologies and ideas can be really challenging. But yeah, blended learning is kind of a, you know, variation on this, I guess. And like you said, it's a mix of face-to-face and online. And so, you know, a typical way you might see that happen in a classroom is, you know, you go into a room and there's 25 kids, and a third of the kids might be working with a teacher on a whole group lesson. And a third of the kids might be working independently at their desks with a book or a tablet or what have you. And then the final third of kids will be working on computer, working on software. And so, and they'll rotate among the different stations. And so, you know, the idea is that by kind of leveraging the power of software to kind of work on specific parts of, you know, specific skills or specific subject areas, that smaller groups of students can get more individualized attention from the teacher as well. Sometimes, you know, it works. A lot of times, you know, there's a sense that it is used as a way to raise class sizes and save money. And, you know, it can be very challenging to make it an integrated experience for a student. So, you know, it's still a challenge for a lot of schools to implement effectively, but it's increasingly popular.
Well, we did a show a few years ago on the flipped classroom, which sounds a little bit like this, where I think the idea is that when you're in the classroom, you're interacting, having discussions with the teacher. And when you're home, you're watching maybe video lessons. And then you go back to school the next day, and then you're discussing them with the teacher. And that's been, you know, people are really gung-ho about that idea.
Yeah, there's a lot of focus these days on what many people call kind of 21st century skills. And you know, I think the basic idea is that in most workplaces now, the things that are really valued are not necessarily how much you know about photosynthesis, but more so your ability to work with a team to figure out how you can harness the power of photosynthesis to solve alternative energy related problems. And so, you know, the idea is that technology can be used, potentially can be used, to create classroom environments where the work of the classroom is much more around this kind of problem solving and critical thinking and, you know, being able to kind of connect your own experience to the larger world and doing these kind of creative expression, you know, a lot of the more engaging things that happen. Now, making that actually happen in reality is
right,
a challenge.
It sounds great. I mean, it sounds great. And engaging and
and great teachers. And, you know, if you go to many schools, you'll go in and you'll see, you know, one teacher or maybe a couple teachers who have figured out ways to do that. And you'll see a couple teachers who, you know, kind of don't have anything to do with technology and they're still using the chalkboard. And most teachers, I think, are somewhere in the middle. You know, they see the power. They kind of understand it. It's hard to make changes. They don't really have a lot of time to prepare for it. There's not a lot of space to try new things and fail and have that be okay. There's very little effective training around it. And so there's this kind of curve, like almost a distribution of how you see these kind of you know, whether it's blended learning or flipped classroom or personalized learning or whatever it may be, almost with any of them, you'll see this kind of distribution where few kind of gung-ho early adopters are doing great and amazing things and everyone gets all excited. And a few at the other end are kind of, we're not going to try any of this because we want to do what we've always done. And then in the middle, it's a kind of a lot of,
Right. Well, I want to talk more about teachers and how they're handling the technology. Let me just reintroduce you. I'm talking to Benjamin Harold. He's a staff writer for Education Week, where he covers education technology. And we're talking about what's working in digital education. Well, let's talk about how teachers are working with this technology. And as you said, one of the criticisms has been that there hasn't been much training for teachers in terms of the best uses of this technology.
So I spent time, I guess, about a year or so ago at Mount Pleasant High School in Delaware, and it was really great. And so, you know, really saw this kind of distribution playing out. There was a teacher named Robin Houghton who I spent time with, and she was doing just amazing things. So, you know, you'd sit in her class and you wouldn't even know that she was the teacher because the students were really kind of leading a lot of the activities themselves. If you went and talked, you know, as I went and talked, sat down next to them and talked to them about what they're working on, it was all kind of the same project. They were working on kind of research projects around social justice issues, but they were each choosing their own topics, kind of picking the way that they wanted to do the research. Some were going to present their findings through music videos that they were creating. Others were writing traditional research papers. Others were, you know, building kind of multimedia presentations that they were going to do. And her job, as she saw it, was really kind of circulating around making – she was able to track with, you know, her laptop what she was able to see on her computer, what each student was working on, and have this, you know, sense of here's how I can help student A versus student B, and circulated doing that. But there was very little of her kind of in the front of the classroom leading everyone through
lecturing
through something.
Or
right. And so the students loved it. And I, you know, I talked with one girl who, you know, she was really into music production. And so she had had this kind of private passion for a long time of writing lyrics and singing songs and doing all of this. And then she had been struggling in writing and literacy for a long time. Not a bad student, but just not doing as well as she probably could have been doing. And so because she was able to bring that passion for music production to the classroom, the teacher said, oh, well, you still have to write your research paper, but we can also turn that into, you know, a chance for you to produce a song about what you're working on. And, you know, we're using technology in this kind of other way. It wasn't just about here's what you're strong on, here's what you're weak on, but as a way to kind of engage her passions. And in the course of doing that, you know, what she found was that, you know, created the space for her to have these conversations with the teacher about, okay, you can express your ideas really deeply in kind of complicated ways when you're writing song lyrics. It's kind of the same when you're writing a paper. And, you know, having those kind of, and so, you know, she started to really improve her abilities in the classroom, academically as well.
So that's like an ideal.
Yeah, it was really powerful to see.
Right.
And you see it and you're like, yeah, like this is great, personalized learning. And then, you know, down the hall, you know, I sat in with another teacher who, you know, was equally kind of enthusiastic about technology, but just was really still struggling with it. And so, mm-hmm. you know, it was an economics class and he was, you know, presenting a lesson and there was a PowerPoint and, you know, mm-hmm. the lesson. And so he was using the technology, you know, there yeah. was a projector and a screen and he had.
PowerPoints aren't always right. incredibly engaging.
But so, you know, going from kind of chalkboard to whiteboard to PowerPoint isn't the same thing as kind of going from lecture to this kind of, hands-on, personalized, everyone kind of engaging their passions model. And so it takes a lot to get there.
So there's a wide range of what teachers are doing with it. And I imagine, I mean, there's a lot of this, a lot of the curriculums are for free. They're sort of open source. You know, it must take a lot of time for a teacher to sort through, say they're doing a project on ancient Egypt. I mean, there must be hundreds of videos they could show, hundreds of materials, and they presumably have to kind of sort through that and figure out a plan that would best integrate that into a lesson. And
that's one of the big challenges, both for educators and for vendors and people who are developing software on this now, is that there's just this kind of tidal wave, and there's all of the paid products, there's free apps, there's what they call open educational resources, which are free and open source, and you can kind of take and use as you want. But there's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them. And so increasingly what you see is this kind of new class of company coming in and saying, well, we'll be the one who helps you organize it. So, schools might buy what they call a learning management system that will either say, we're going to commit to these particular materials, or it's kind of a central platform and we'll pull everything in. And so, Miss Jones, when she wants to try and develop her lessons, she can select YouTube videos for this student and, kind of online math tutorials for this student and a traditional kind of textbook lesson for that student. It's the place where all of that kind of happens. But again, it's kind of very much in flux. And, what I think a lot of teachers are experiencing right now is that my school or my district is trying this thing this year and another thing next year and then a third thing the third year. And there's kind of not that kind of continuity and opportunity to grow. And that can really lead to a lot of frustration in this, well, why should I invest in this now? There's good reason for me to want to do what I've always done, because at least I know that works and that will still be around next year.
And that's our Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder talking with Education Week reporter Benjamin Harold about whether all this digital technology in schools is helping or hurting students and how it is changing the classroom. More after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain. Schools are filled with technology. A lot of students' work is done online. Producer Debbie Bilder has been talking with Benjamin Harold, a staff writer for Education Week, about how all this technology is changing how students learn and how teachers teach. Let's get back to their conversation.
Another concern about a lot of the digital technology in school is that a lot of kids don't have access to it. There are particularly rural, poor communities still lack broadband or wireless. What percentage of kids, what percentage of households actually have access to the internet?
One of the things that we do know is that in terms of families with school-age children, that most have some kind of internet access, up well above 90%. But what we see is that families below the poverty line, as many as a third of those families are relying on mobile-only access. So there's no laptop. It's a smartphone with a data plan. And so if you're trying to use that for schoolwork, that presents real problems, particularly if there's multiple people sharing that device or, if there's trouble paying for it or you're running up against your data limits. All of those things are problems. And then, in terms of home broadband access or wireless access, what you see in a lot of districts is, there's this increasing sense that it's kind of a 24/7 learning environment. So kids should be able to take their technology home. A lot of teachers are assigning online homework, and the kids get home, and even if they're bringing a device home from students from school, they can't get online. And so, some districts are trying things like, putting Wi-Fi on their school buses or partnering with Starbucks and McDonald's in the communities.
Or
to make
libraries.
Sure
that they're open, or libraries. Kids go to libraries.
They tend to like the McDonald's better, I think.
Right. And rural communities are also classrooms. I mean, this has been a big push for Obama.
It has. For Education Week, we spent time in two rural communities over the past year. I was in Calhoun County, Mississippi for an extended period, and it was a pretty eye-opening experience because it was a small district, a sweet potato farming community, and went into the school, and they had been getting billed $9,750 a month for their internet service, which is a lot of money, and it didn't work. And so, I sat down with the school secretary, and she was the one responsible for kind of entering attendance every morning. And it was just like the most painful thing that you've ever experienced, because every time, the connection was so slow, every time she would try and enter a student's name, she's required by the state to do this. Like, she doesn't have any choice. She has to do it. You enter the name, and you'll just see the wheel spin for 30 seconds. 60 seconds, and she's just like pulling her hair out. Right. And every morning,
it's like the old days for a lot of us.
Yeah, and so there are schools that are still very few that are still working on dial-up, but you know that have these kind of old copper connections. And you know, again, this thing where you know they got this federal money several years ago as part of the stimulus to say, okay, let's bring in interactive whiteboards and let's have computers, and then oh wait. We can't get our kids or our staff online. And because it's a rural community, there's just not a lot of people there. There's not a lot of customers there. And there's not a lot of companies who want to come in and, you know, lay this very expensive fiber optic cable to bring high-speed connection to, you know, 100 kids in a school and not be able to make any money off it. And so the federal government has, you know, really been working hard to try and find ways around that. And so, you know, there's a huge push underway right now to, you know, kind of make all this new money available, but also to kind of change the rules a little bit.
Well, you know, related to this access issue, people have raised some concerns about, you know, this push for digital technology actually sort of heightening disparities, education disparities between the kids who, you know, have access all the time. They have the newest gadgets. They're really comfortable with gadgets. And then kids who might be lower income kids who have less access to new laptops and all the apps and things like that.
Yeah, and one of the ways that we've seen that kind of expressed just recently is, as you know, a lot of the state standardized testing is moving online. And so when kids sit down in the springtime to take the test that says how they did and how their school did and potentially even how their teacher did, you know, it's a computerized test. And so one of those tests is called the PARC exams. It's administered in New Jersey and 10 other states last year, and it'll be a few fewer states this year. And so what we found when we started digging into the results of that is that students actually did much better in some cases on the paper-based version of the exam, which is still given about 20% of the time depending on where you are, than on the computer-based version of the exam. Now, it's supposed to be the same test covering the same material, you know, at the same time. And so, you know, it kind of raises this concern of like, okay, there's this level of familiarity with the technology that students need to be able to have to succeed in this new environment. And it's really basic things that you almost kind of, you know, it's very easy to take for granted, but this idea that there's many students who don't have experience or aren't familiar with how to scroll through a window on on a screen. Or a lot of the new items might have kind of drag and drop functionality where you're solving a math problem, not by hand, but you have to click on something with your mouse and kind of drag it across the screen. And many students have never had that experience before or aren't familiar with how to do that. And they might know how to do the math. If you gave them a piece of paper,
right,
they could do it.
But are distracted by trying to figure out.
By trying to figure out how to do it.
Right.
And so there's a lot of concern that the gaps around that is kind of breaking out by income and racial and ethnic lines. And making sure that everyone has kind of equal access to that is a huge deal right now.
Is any part of that, I know there have been a few studies looking at this sort of difference between paper and pencil tests versus online. Is there any connection between the way our brains work differently, looking at a computer, answering questions on a computer, then doing it, you know, the old-fashioned way?
I think that it's still very much up in the air, and people are still, you know, trying to figure out exactly what happens. And again, it kind of varies from test to test and so forth. On the testing piece, I think really the level is kind of familiarity with the, the technology and the interface. But there is this whole other body of research that kind of looks at how all of us, you know, adults included, but students increasingly, you know, what happens in our brains when we're reading online or reading on screens as opposed to reading on paper. And there is a lot of concern about what it means for comprehension. And there's kind of a general sense that, you know, it's almost kind of a neurological thing that if we're, you know, reading on screen, we're almost like hunter-gatherers. We're searching for information or, you know, cat videos or whatever it may be. But, you know, we're
hopefully not at school.
Well, but, you know, the sense of you're kind of gathering information but not necessarily engaging with it deeply. And if you really want to, you know, do the things that, you know, in most high school English classes, your high school English teacher is going to want you to do of kind of think about the author's purpose or, you know, relate this story to your own experience or take this text and that text and see where the similarities and differences are. If you're reading that all online, it can be much harder to do. And, you know, I think if you step back for a second, or if I step back for a second, I see that in my own experience too. You know, if I'm writing a, you know, complicated, involved story for Education Week, you know, I'll end up with a stack of papers next to me and I'm highlighting them. And, you know, I used to kind of feel like I was just this dinosaur doing this thing because I, you know, I'm old now. But when I started reading the research, it's like there's actually a good reason for that. It's much easier to do the kind of deep understanding and deep engagement with a text when it's something you can hold and in front of you and on paper as opposed just on screen.
Well, I've heard teachers complain about that, you know, the attention span of kids, that they have less analytical way of thinking. So you're saying there may be those changes when you do stuff online, when you do work online?
There's definitely a body of research that looks at that in terms of reading on screens. And then there's a second problem that you'll see, particularly for elementary students, where a lot of the digital reading materials that are created for them, often by, you know, companies or publishers, they have a lot of bells and whistles in them.
Yeah, they look like, I have to say, because I have a third grader, they look like video games. I mean, basically.
Right. And so, and I bet your third grader, like, gets very excited to interact
with
them.
Right, right. They get little prizes. Yeah. They get to dress the characters up in different, you know,
and you can
outfits.
And touch this part of the screen and you hear sounds in this part of the screen and something else happens. Mm-hmm. And all of that is wonderfully engaging and it's a real kind of benefit of the technology. But the downside of it is it doesn't necessarily help you pay attention and focus.
I'm talking with Ben Harold. He's a staff writer for Education Week, where he covers education technology. And we're discussing education technology in schools. Is it helping or hurting education? And what do we know so far about what's working and what's not? I read a recent Wall Street Journal article talking about, you know, we're used to kids doing stuff on laptops and on tablets, but this article was about more and more kids by choice. I don't think just it wasn't just an access issue, but, you know, writing term papers on their smartphones, which, I mean, I guess kids just have this, you know, an ability that I cannot imagine, but I don't think it's a bad thing, but it's just completely different.
And in some cases, it may be a bad thing. And in some cases, it may or may not be a choice that that student has too. And I think that's where kind of the rubber hits the road, where mm-hmm. as I've kind of gone into this work, one of the things that people have pushed me to think about is to understand it not as either or, this is better or this is worse, but that the way our society works now and increasingly the way our schools work is that you have to have both sets of companies. So you have to be able to kind of think deeply and critically and, you know, be able to work with things on paper and understand it. But there's also this kind of separate set of skills that it takes to be able to work on a computer, to use a Google Doc, to pound out a term paper on your phone, and that there's a value in that. And there's going to be a workplace value in that, and there's kind of an intellectual value in that. But if it's only that, and if it's replacing as opposed to supplementing, that's where you start to run into the problem.
Well, it sounds like you're saying there's sort of good and bad things with digital education, and we're sort of experimenting still. But there are a number of schools that are completely online, a number of charter schools. There are also some public schools that are all online. What do the studies say about those?
Not much that is good, particularly for cyber charter schools. There was a big, large, comprehensive study that came out last year that looked at nationwide, the cyber charter sector, which serves about 200,000 students right now. And, you know, basically the idea is that it's a full-time online school. So you don't go into a building, you log in the morning, and that's, you know, that's your school experience. And a lot of these are kind of statewide schools. So it might be a school with 4, 5, 10,000 students who are scattered all across Pennsylvania or Ohio or Colorado or what have you. And the teachers might have a student load or a caseload of 100 students, 150 students, 500 students mm-hmm. in some cases. I mean, the figures can get astronomical. And so the study found that, you know, it was one of the more remarkable kind of press calls with a researcher I had ever been on because, you know, we were all kind of pressing, like, how bad is it? How bad is it? And she said, okay, statistically, it's on the math results, it's statistically as if the students didn't go to school for a year.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it was almost as if they were regressing, at least on math, by virtue of being in these schools. And I know there's some variation, but, you know, even some of the biggest backer of full-time online charter schools, you know, the Walton Family Foundation, for example, which has given a lot of money to school choice and including cyber charters, has said, you know, these results were so bad that we have to reconsider how we're giving money.
So clearly that face-to-face interaction, that sort of traditional student-teacher connection, the way that kind of instruction works, is still incredibly valuable.
Particularly when you're looking at scale. So, you know, what you find for like full-time online schools is that might work really well if you're training for the Olympics or if you, you know, move around all the time or, you know, you have a particular acute problem, you're being bullied in school and you don't have another choice and you need a temporary outlet. There are good things about it, but the idea that it's can be a kind of a system that works for a lot of students for a long period of time, there's not a lot of evidence to support that. But what you'll see is, you know, schools taking bits and pieces of it. So I was in a school in northern New Jersey last month. And what they're doing is saying, no, we don't want to do a full-time virtual school, but we're going to do work-from-home days. And so it's kind of this idea started with the snow day. Okay, so we don't want to, you know, our teachers don't want to have to come back in over spring break, or we don't have, you know, have to add a day at the end of the school year, and a lot of our stuff is online anyway. So if there's a snow day, we'll just kind of let students log in and do their activities then, and we'll count it as a day. But now schools are saying, well, let's take it a step further, and we'll do a work-from-home day, mm-hmm. where the whole school has the choice to kind of stay home and, you know, work in their PJs. And I was, you know, with a group of 10th grade girls, you know, and yeah. they were, like, eating pretzels and, you know, chit-chatting and working on their homework at their kitchen table.
And working.
And working. During the school day. And they loved it. And so, you know, I think that what you see more and more is calls from some parents and some educators to say, maybe we should slow down a little bit. Maybe we should, you know, it's not that we don't want any technology, but let's be a little more thoughtful in how we're doing it and a little more thoughtful in how we're kind of evaluating what we're doing before we start spending a lot of money and really changing the experience that our children are having.
But you've written about sort of some of the ideal ways this technology has been is being used. And in fact, you profiled a private school in Boston that's sort of doing really innovative things. Now it's a private school. I think it, you know, it's $50,000 a year or something. But kids are using the technology in really interesting ways.
Yeah, it was pretty mind-blowing to go there because the school's called Beaver Country Day. And it's about $43,000 a year. And I talked to a dad who had two kids there at the same time. And he was like, you must really love this school. And so, but he did.
Yep.
And part of the reason why is because it wasn't just what they were doing in the building, but they had kind of expanded the school to these other sites. And the one was called New View. And it was a partnership with MIT, which not every school is going to be able to have, and they do. But they call it, you know, a lot of schools have a version of this. It was kind of they call it a makerspace. The idea that getting students kind of building and experimenting and doing really hands-on work on stuff that they care about is a great way for kids to learn. And, you know, you'll see that in a lot of schools and libraries. They'll have kind of smaller makerspaces. In this case, you know, it's with MIT engineers, and they have, you know, lots of 3D printers and laser cutters. And,
right. Hit you know, a lot at their fingertips.
I talked with a group of 10th graders, and they were working on their project, and they just, you know, they had to come up with a project. And they said, well, what we're going to make is, you know, an IV kit for high-altitude climbers. So if you start to suffer hypothermia when you're, you know, doing high altitude climbing, you have this kit that you can plug into your water bottle and save yourself. And I was like, okay. And then you look at it and it's like, I want to take that with me on my camping trip because it was so great what they were making. But, you know, from soup to nuts in the course of 2 weeks, you know, in these kind of makerspace environments, you'll see students designing it, conceptualizing it, working on computers to rough it out. They print prototypes on 3D printers and they have it in their hands. And then they're, you know, coding, you know, and using sensors and hardware to actually kind of build the thing together. And it's nothing like what I could have imagined doing back when I was in 10th grade.
But is this sort of what proponents of digital education, is this what they're imagining in, you know, 5 years, 10 years, this is what classrooms are going to look like?
I think it depends on who you ask. And I think that increasingly there's a sense that the kind of time frame we're talking about might be a little longer than people originally anticipated. And so, you know, one way of thinking about that is think about Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook. He has made a commitment to education, and he recently decided that, you know, his philanthropic focus in education is going to be around all of the stuff we're talking about, personalized learning, education technology. And he and his wife are going to devote an extraordinary sum of money to that, about $45 billion is the current estimation. But the way they talk about it now is it's a 30, 40, 50-year time frame. And so 5, 10 years from now, will things look different? Probably, you know, we'll see new technologies, we'll see new strategies. Some of the things that you and I are kind of discussing will probably take more root, and others, you know, will be seen as kind of archaic in 5 years. But I think the hope for a lot of folks in Silicon Valley and a lot of the venture capitalists and a lot of the, you know, the education reformers who are pouring a lot of money into this is that a generation from now, the idea that school isn't happening on the internet or that there's not kind of this big data approach to understanding what each student can do and can't do and what their preferences are, the idea that it's not a highly customized experience for everyone, that 25 years from now, they'll be very surprised if it doesn't look like that.
Benjamin Harold, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking with Benjamin Harold. He's a staff writer for Education Week, where he covers education technology and writes for the Digital Education blog. I'm Debbie Builder.
And for more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/radiotimes and stay with WHYY for hour 2 of Radio Times. Coming up next, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.